Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to the Fast Forward Radio Archives on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this program, which originally aired November 4th, 2007. This is my second consecutive week playing hooky back in the early days of Fast Forward Radio on Blog Talk Radio. And so once again, you have the dynamic duo of Stephen Gordon and Mike Sargent. This week, talking about the singularity and also talking about the DARPA Urban Challenge. It's pretty interesting to see how some of the speculations that we put in place around the DARPA Urban Challenge, although these many years ago, have begun panning out. Interesting that we get to check in on these issues every once in a while. It's a great show. It's a lot of fun. Hope you will enjoy it. We will be back on live Wednesday with Fast Forward Radio, The Jobless Boom. We'll be welcoming our good friend Alvis Bridges back to the program. We're going to talk about how automation and accelerating technological change impact the economy, especially the job market. We've been doing a little bit of blogging around that. Had a post called The Jobless Boom last week. Currently running a survey to gauge opinion on where the economy is going, what people think the future economy is going to be like. So if you haven't had a chance to participate in that, do stop by blog.speculus.com and check out our survey. Saturday, we will be continuing our series, The World Transformed Archives, with part 6 of The World Transformed, Risks, Dystopia, and Unsettling Futures. This was a terrific show. We had a great panel, Sonia Arison and Philip Van Nederveld, talking about current and future existential risks, talking about the dangers that threaten civilization itself, and what, if anything, we can do about them. Well, I hope you'll be able to join us for all of these upcoming programs, and I hope you will enjoy this blast from the past, this program on the Singularity and the DARPA Urban Challenge from 2007, which begins right now. And until next time, live to see it.
Welcome to the Fast Forward Radio Show for November 4, 2007. This is the official podcast of the Speculist Weblog. I'm Stephen Gordon. Co-hosting with me again this week is Michael Sargent. Hi, Michael.
Good evening, Stephen.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good, good. Michael is subbing again this week for Phil Bauermaster. Phil is serving as our correspondent in the field again this week. He attended the Foresight Nanotech Unconference this weekend, and I'm sure he'll have a lot to report when he returns to the show next week. We are happy to have Michael with us this week. If you are listening to the show live, you can contribute to the show, and we hope you do, by calling us at 347-215-8972. And the text chat is open as well. Well, Mike, how has your week been? I think you've done some traveling, is that right?
My week's been great. I have been doing some traveling, visiting some family and friends in Wyoming and northern Colorado. In fact, I'm coming to you from the beautiful Valentine City of Loveland, Colorado this evening.
All right. Well, and Loveland is famous for Valentine's. Do they actually make the Valentine's there, or what do they do?
Well, they postal cancel Valentine's, and it's the most popular station cancellation during the year of any special cancellation you can get in the United States Postal Service.
Okay.
Several million Valentine's pass through on a given year.
Well, and they're set up for that, I guess. They know how to handle them now. And they're also famous for one other thing that I understand you were telling me about before the show started.
Well, we're just down the road from the infamous Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, where Stephen King got his ideas for the movie The Shining, and has recently been featured on Sci-Fi Network's Ghost Hunters.
Yeah. Well, that was, I don't know, was that the same hotel that was actually used when they filmed the movie with...
Not the
Jack Nicholson
movie.
What's that?
Not the Jack Nicholson movie, but the miniseries that was on, I believe it was ABC a few years ago.
Okay, okay. Well, I've had a much less eventful week. We're just working, and then this weekend, working in the yard some, cut a little firewood. I got a lawn tip, and I think I'm going to share this with our listeners, Michael.
We're always up for new technology.
Yeah, well, this is not new technology. It's sometimes old information can be useful, too. This old grandfatherly type guy in my neighborhood was out in his yard, and he had a wheelbarrow, and in his wheelbarrow was baby powder. And I'm talking like baby powder, like talcum powder. And I was, what in the world is this guy doing? So I went over and just visited with him. He has been doing this for years, and he uses it to kill fire ants. And yeah. This stuff's, you know, as you know, talcum powder is like the farthest thing from poisonous in the world. It's cheap. It's readily available. He just puts it on top of the fire ant bed. Now, he was coating it kind of thick. I mean, it was not like a small amount of stuff that he was putting on the fire ant bed. But, I mean, it was, he put it on there, and, like, he says the next day they're dead. And of course, I had to try it. I went out and got some baby powder, and I've put it out in my yard. I guess I can report it to everyone next week whether it works or not, but I have every reason to believe that this guy was telling me the truth. And
I'd be interested in hearing that. I've heard similar uses, similar applications of talcum powder on insects.
Yeah.
And did you know that it's actually a nanotech application?
Well, why is that?
It's a mechanical attack on the exoskeleton of the creature.
Okay.
It actually physically breaches the ant's exterior defenses and does away with them, much like bullets would attack humans.
Well, that would explain it, wouldn't it? It doesn't have to be poisonous as long as it gets inside them and screws up their chemistry in some way. That's cool. I see in the chat room we've got Matt Doing again, and I'm glad to see him there. Matt, you were telling me in an email here a while back that you're starting a blog. If you've started that, make sure to give us the blog name, and we'll shout it out on the radio show. The other great news for this weekend was LSU won their game again yesterday, and I was happy about that. That was a great game. LSU and Alabama, I mean, they fought back and forth. Alabama was
a rivalry.
Oh, man. Alabama at the halftime was up, and, you know, LSU fans that couldn't take it were giving up. It was brutal. And then won it at the end with a defensive play that basically forcing an error on the Alabama quarterback where he fumbled the ball, and they picked it up and pretty much were within reach of an easy touchdown after that, and that was the end of the game. It was quite a game. Exciting.
Good to hear someone's home team's doing well.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I guess you're referring again to the to baseball, I guess.
Well, and you may not have watched the Broncos game today either, so we'll leave that where that one lays. did you notice the other competition that went on this weekend? In a more futurist line.
Oh, well, yeah, actually I did, but I understand you've been keeping up with it, so tell us about it. What was going on?
We have a little bit of sports breaking news from the futurist aspect. Some listeners may remember the DARPA Grand Challenge of the last couple of years with various collegiate and sponsored teams fielding auto-driven, self-driven automobiles. Well, this year they sponsored the DARPA Urban Challenge. Several teams competed. It was whittled down to 21 teams on Saturday, and we have the finishers. Final score as of today, Carnegie Mellon and GM came in first, Stanford second, and Virginia Tech third, on a 60-mile course, driving in simulated urban conditions, including human drivers in traffic.
You know, I wonder what they paid the people that provided the traffic for these robots. It's, you know, there was some danger involved in that, I guess.
There was. There was some destruction of property. A couple of the teams that were eliminated earlier in the weekend were eliminated by mechanical failures due to crash.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's good to see the Virginia Tech team finishing in the top three. Their number 32 car was dedicated to their students and faculty members that were injured earlier this year in the unfortunate events on their campus.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and so yeah, they that's awesome that they were able to place and to have a vehicle that finished. That's quite. I mean, to me, this is a more challenging challenge than the off-road challenge would have been a couple of years ago.
And I mean, how much progress have we made in the last 3 years? The first DARPA Grand Challenge, none of the vehicles finished the course. In fact, none of the vehicles made it beyond the first mile.
Yeah.
And here we are 2 years later, and not only did they finish the course last year, but three teams finished this year, and it was a much more complicated interactive environment.
Hey, did you see what the cash prizes are?
The cash prizes were pretty substantial. The Carnegie Mellon team, which had some sponsorship by General Motors, pulled down $2 million for the Boss vehicle.
Yeah.
Stanford's team, which not only finished the course with the best time, but also garnered comments on the smoothness of their ride, pulled $1 million, and Virginia Tech got $500,000.
Well, and I was gratified that Virginia Tech was in the top three, but also that Stanford was again as well. Obviously, Stanford has you know, really poured a lot of resources into being in these contests, and of course they won it when it was the off-road challenge, and now they did quite well in this urban challenge, and I'm glad for them as well. Yeah, I heard comments, or read comments anyway, at Popular Mechanics about how the Boss vehicle, which is the vehicle that won, that's the Carnegie Mellon vehicle, it was a jerky ride, apparently. If there had been a human aboard, they'd have gotten beat up, because, I mean, it was, you know, when it was time to accelerate, it was pedal to the metal. When it was time to stop, it was, you know, full brake, and then, you know, jerky steering and all that, but the Stanford vehicle apparently was much smoother and graceful in its maneuvers, but it wasn't quite as fast. And
Carnegie Mellon sounds like some college students I've driven with.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And maybe you know, once the Boss vehicle graduates from college, it'll smooth out a little bit. But in the meantime, I think I'd rather ride in the Stanford vehicle. I have to agree with Matt's comment here in the chat room. He says that he can't wait for this technology to hit the market. Yeah, this would be real nice. This would be the sort of thing, you know, if I wanted to come to Colorado and visit y'all, go skiing or something, Mike, I could, you know, basically just fill up the van with gas and go to sleep in the back and let it drive me through the night, you know.
Lends a new meaning to let Hertz do the driving.
Yeah, exactly. They would do the driving with their vehicle. So... Yeah, and it's I'm sure they pour, you know, the computer resources that it takes to make this happen are substantial. But you know, the way computer prices are going down all the time, you know, the size of the computer, necessary computers are shrinking all the time. You know, pretty soon it would disappear to the point that it would not mean much as far as the space it would take up. You know, they got full server racks and things in these things now.
Good quote from the leader of the MIT team regarding their entry. There's more computing power in the back seat than most companies have.
Yeah.
It's like all the PCs in your company.
Yeah, and I don't think he's thinking about my law firm with our, you know, 15, you know, aged computers. He's thinking about like a mid-sized company probably. There's some serious computer power in those things. Approaching supercomputer status, probably, if you look at them like a Beowulf cluster or something in the back of these back of these vehicles. But you know, these things shrink, and the time it takes to shake out the bugs in these systems anyway, it'll, you know, the necessary computer power will be much smaller, and so yeah, look forward to seeing these in vehicles and being able to hit the road and let the vehicle drive us.
I'm afraid I'll have to wait until AAA will cover a blue screen of death failure.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's the whole thing. At what point are we going to be willing to give up driving? And I say for me, I will give up the driving to the computer when I see the statistics showing that it is safer to allow the computer to drive than to drive myself. And
absolutely, and it won't be too long after that it will be mandated in particularly dangerous or otherwise hazardous circumstances.
Right.
Driving long distance along long straight stretches of highway in the middle of the night, when we find that the computer is less apt to go to sleep than a human operator.
Yeah, and I wonder, and it seemed to me that would be an easy bit of driving for the computer anyway. Those long straight stretches in the middle of the night is perfect for a computer. Whereas in the middle of the city, it might be a while before the computers would be up to par for a stop and go with traffic coming this way and that way, and knowing when it's when the vehicle that's approaching us from the right is going to stop, and you just some of this is almost instinctual,
in many ways.
Yeah, and I just wonder, that kind of driving, it may be a while before the computer is actually better. You know, I could see driving along and a little message popping up. We've analyzed this driving situation, and the computer believes that it could actually be safer at this time than the human driver. Would you like to, you see what I'm saying? Yes or no?
Would you like to invoke the auto chauffeur? Yes.
Yeah, you hit yes, and then kick back and listen to some tunes. That wouldn't be too bad, and
that's not too far away from technology that's already been deployed in terms of monitoring driver status for either intoxicated driving or speed driving. There are systems that will monitor habits of driving that will detect whether you're drifting further in your lane than is normal for your driving habit.
Yeah,
and,
the computer has determined that you're either sleepy or drunk. Please let me take over. I can see that happening too. So that's cool, and hopefully that'll come around sooner than later. And I tell you, I'm a personal injury lawyer, Mike, and I still want it to hurry up. I'm not such a buzzard that I want to. I would want this to stay at bay. I want this to be developed as soon as possible. But anyway, Phil attended the 2007 Singularity Summit, and he got for us he interviewed some of the other participants at the Singularity Summit. And we're going to play those here in just a little while. And what their thoughts were as far as the singularity and their hopes and fears and those sort of things. But what I want to get into tonight, Mike, is one of the keynote addresses. You're, of course, familiar with Eliezer Yudowsky.
I've done some reading just recently.
Yeah. He is he's brilliant. He is the founder of the It's the group that's I'm having a mental block, but anyway, he is a founder of a foundation that's goal is to help develop friendly AI, and so he thought long and hard about what the singularity means, and he sort of took a swipe in his speech at some of the imprecise singularity commentary that he's seen, like in the blogosphere, and I'm sure also from mainstream media types too. He says that the problem is that there are really three major schools of thought on the singularity, and that people will use the same term singularity to describe, any of these three things.
Three particular kinds of events?
Well, let me just kind of get into what the schools are. He talked about Ray Kurzweil's accelerating change school, okay? And he described the thanks Matt. It's the Singularity Institute. Matt was telling me Eliezer Yudowsky is a co-founder of the Singularity Institute. Anyway,
Good catch.
Yeah, thank you. Anyway, the Accelerating Change School, he described the school this way. Human intuitions about the future are linear, but technology change feeds on itself and therefore accelerates. People expect about as much change in the future as they've seen in the past, if not less. But technology progress feeds on itself. The more we learn, the more we learn. So the future will contain more technological change than people expect. And that in a nutshell, is the Accelerating Change School. Now, Ray Kurzweil has had, you know, in his books, he's covered a lot more ground than that. But that's one of his main ideas and the thrust of at least two of his recent books. And so, anyway, and then...
One of the best examples that Kurzweil forwards, to put it in a context or perspective, were the predictions of New York City being buried in horse waste by the turn of the last century because people could not envision the accelerating change that led to streetcars first and then gasoline-powered automobiles.
Yeah, that's a great example. I think that was in the Age of Spiritual Machines, wasn't it? I believe that example he gave. Yeah, and they would have been right. The people that predicted that New York was going to be buried in horse manure would have been right had the car not come along. And so but they couldn't foresee that. And so there's so much about the future we can't foresee because we don't know where the technological and sometimes, especially if we're thinking linearly, we aren't thinking about what these technological changes can bring about. And one of the things that Kurzweil gets criticized for is that Kurzweil believes that he can, you know, basically, like when you go hunting for ducks, you lead your shot so that you know where to shoot. You shoot ahead of the duck in order to hit the duck. Kurzweil kind of believes that he can look ahead and know where we're going to be in a few years, and he feels like he kind of has to, since he's in the business of inventing things, and to kind of know what the market's going to need when, he needs to be able to lead it and understand it, and that's kind of what got him started as a futurist. He was an inventor first.
By being more radical than the next guy.
That's right. Yeah, being radical enough to be realistic, you know? For a different reason, the next guy that had an idea and basically came up with a school of thought on the singularity is Werner Vinge. By the way, for 20 years, I mispronounced in my mind whenever I, you know, read his books and things. I mispronounced Werner Vinge's first name and his last name. But I'm glad now that I think I've got it right. So at any rate, if I lapse back into calling him Bernard Vinge, you stop me, okay, Mike?
I will.
Okay, thanks. It's Werner Vinge, and he came up with a technological event horizon. Now, Vinge's background was a math professor, and he's also a sci-fi author. And he has a particular affinity for writing very good, hard sci-fi. But he would look out into the future and try to write hard science fiction. That means science fiction that's doesn't have a lot of fantasy elements. He wants to describe what he thinks it will really be like. And we would look out in the future and say, well, you know, we get this development, and then pretty soon we've got greater than human level intelligence, and then, well, I can't really say what people that are smarter than me would do. And he felt that his crystal ball cracked at that point, and he called that the technological singularity. He is the first person to call it the singularity, and he named it after, you know, what the physicists would call the, you know, that point in physical space where, you know...
Physical laws break down in the heart of a black hole.
There you go. Thank you. And so he named it after that and called it the technological singularity. And so, you know, all around us, Mike, we see the fruit of our human intellectual capabilities. There's not a single technology in the entire world that we possess that's the product of a mind that is smarter than humans. You know, humans came up with all these things. Creation itself, but we're talking about the technology that we live with. How weird is the world going to be if you see greater than human level intelligences appear? What would they invent? What would they do?
And I think this even goes farther than that. Once we start seeing artificial intelligences that are truly not direct replicas of human level intelligence, whether they be human level intelligence on their own, just different, or whether they be somewhat less capable, I think we're going to start seeing truly alien thought for the first time, unless, of course, we're contacted beforehand.
Yeah. I put my money on AI as far as the human alien thought. Us contacting alien thought, it would be with AI before we contact other aliens. But it's... yeah, you're exactly right, and that's that is a momentous moment, isn't it?
It would be, and just as philosophically earth-shattering as we've often envisioned first contact with the aliens, first contact with our intellectual children in the form of AI might be equally or even more shocking to at least the aware man in the street.
Right. And when you're talking, and you know, we have stories about contacting aliens that in well, you know, you've got E.T. and you've got Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but you also have other movies.
Recently
that are...
you have Invaders from Mars and many of Arthur C. Clarke and others. Aliens come to either ignore us or destroy us.
Right. And so, you know, obviously, and that's kind of what Eliezer Yudowsky and the Singularity Institute is about. They want to make sure that, well, if we're going to do this, let's at least, you know, do it.
Those dice in our favor.
Yeah, that's right. We want an AI to be friendly and to be on our team. We sure don't want a rogue AI that would be against us. So anyway, I appreciate that. You know, that's an important point. Anyway, there's one last school of thought about the singularity, and that's I.J. Good's intelligence explosion. And I.J. Good, another math professor, I believe, basically came up with the idea that once smarter than human intelligence exists, that intelligence will be better able to create even smarter intelligences, and it will spend some of its resources and some of its mental efforts doing that. And then, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You get into a positive feedback loop where advance piles on top of advance, and it runs away from anything we might be able to understand.
Right, and pretty quickly that could happen. Particularly if you put an AI in charge of its own source code, and it could rewrite itself as it needed to, and then maybe even take charge of upgrading its hardware at the same time. You could quickly see how that could be a real explosion, couldn't it?
And Good's intelligence explosion reminds me of a scenario I first ran across reading Dr. Drexler's Engines Creation, one of the first books on nanotechnology.
Right.
And he described a situation where scientists fired up the first two artificially intelligent computers ever devised and connected them together for 60 seconds. And these two artificially intelligent computers weren't designed to be any smarter or more advanced than human intelligence, but simply because of the advantages of other materials over human neurons were so much faster than human minds that after those 60 seconds, once they were disconnected and they were each queried, the scientists asked them what they had talked about, what information they had exchanged, what the subject matter was. The only logical response that these computers could give was everything.
Yeah. And the difference being clock speed. These the amount of time 60 seconds amounts to for a computer versus 60 seconds for a human brain. You know, the difference is clock speed. They're running a computer can run at such fast clock speed that you can they simply could talk about everything in a short period of time. And so, yeah, you give an AI its own source code and allow it to go to work on itself, you get an intelligence explosion if it's as smart as people or smarter. And
I believe the figure that I read earlier today was at current performance levels, just the advantage of silicon over neurons, a computer analog of a human brain to accomplish a year's worth of thinking in 31 seconds. So
yeah.
how many person years of code development can you advance in just a week's worth of work?
Well, and the reason, of course, that human brains are still more powerful than the most powerful computer, even now, is parallel processing. Our individual neurons are firing so much slower than what happens within a computer, but we have so many of them, and they're running in parallel, that our brains are still more powerful than the most powerful supercomputer. But how long until a computer surpasses us? I've seen estimates that it can happen as soon as within a decade. I mean, are you seeing that as well, Michael?
I have seen that estimate. Unfortunately, I've also seen that estimate since I even started becoming aware of the topic back around the 1970s. So it's been just around the corner for 30 years. Now,
got another commenter who said, and humans get tired. That's true, too. Machines don't get tired. Keep the power on, and they can run indefinitely with no sleep or anything. So, yeah, that's right. Anyway, in his speech, Michael, Eliezer pointed out that it's important to keep these concepts separate and distinct. And I agree with that, and I think you do too.
I certainly do. I think the importance of keeping them separate is recognizing that we may not be facing just one singularity per se. I think we're facing at least these three events that go so far beyond our past experience that Werner Vinge's point is well taken. We really can't look beyond this and say with any degree of certainty what's coming next.
Right.
We can make some fairly educated guesses about the parameters that will lead into it, and we can make some less confident speculations about what the extreme possibilities might be. But how things are likely to turn out is a dice throw.
Yeah. Well, and I agree that we got to understand these concepts, Michael, and we got to keep them, and we have to understand them separately. But, you know, we were talking about this a little bit before the show and how important it is to understand these things separately. But I can also kind of understand why these things kind of get morphed together, because these ideas work so well together.
Any combination of the three is a very compelling concept.
Right.
They stand alone on their own, and when you add them together, it becomes something that is, one, very fun to talk about and interesting to imagine, and at its most primal level, also quite scary.
Yeah.
I think Vinge's point, I like to think of Vinge's technological event horizon and I use this term in the most positive way possible, but it's a real failure of imagination. And what it seems to say to me is not so much that we don't have the capacity to imagine what might happen, simply that our wildest dreams may only be the starting point.
Right. And it's just hard to, you know, we have very little we can say useful about what happens afterwards. And as far as what happens afterwards, I think about the only thing that we can say is I.J. Good's point. And let me get to that in just a second. But what I'd like to do is kind of show how these ideas kind of fit together and I want to add, visualize a pyramid. At the base of the pyramid, I would put Ray Kurzweil's observation that accelerating technological development is driving the future. Moore's law is the biggest part of this. You know, as you push forward with something like computers developing, then of course those computers help you develop the next generation of computers, and then you've got accelerating change happening all the time. But that's the most likely path of how we get to the singularity, and that's the base of the pyramid. Okay, the next level up, then after that would be Werner Vinge's observation that we just can't, we reach a point where by whatever means we develop greater than human level intelligence, we really at this point can't say much about what follows because we really can't understand what follows. And then above that, at the very top of the pyramid, I would put I.J. Goode's observation that an intelligent explosion would happen because once you get greater than human level intelligence, part of what a greater than human level intelligence would do would be to develop the next greater than human level intelligence, and boom, it explodes at that point. And so, beyond that, we can't say too much about what would happen after the singularity. Our models of predicting kind of break down. Doesn't mean that society breaks down. In fact, it probably would go the other way. Society would just be, so much better. But our model of predicting
in the face of this these sorts of advances. One thing that also parallels this is the concept of transhumanism and incorporating some of these advances into what we would consider the normal human capability.
Mm-hmm.
And some of this is happening even now. I know we've discussed in the past, if we leave the cell phone behind and the laptop behind or the PDA, we begin to feel a little brain damaged with lack of immediate access to information.
Yeah, I find that without my laptop and the ability to Google all these various concepts I'm learning all the time, I feel like I'm half my brain has been left behind, and imagine how much more it will feel that way when we really are jacked in all the time, And things will be different by whatever means we reach human level, greater than human level intelligence. Things will be much different in weirder ways than, flying cars, which is a favorite thing we always like to talk about at the Speculus and things like that. But I mean, those are ideas that humans have come up with, jetpack around or what, crazy ideas like that, what we imagine the future to be like, but
I'm reminded here at this point of some of the scenes from Back to the Future where Doc Brown is envisioning some of the technologies that will occur in the next 50 years and is going off down the Buck Rogers Flash Gordon trail, and we cut to 1985, and we're given Huey Lewis in the News and DeLorean cars as our examples of cutting-edge technology.
Right.
The future will definitely be weirder than we expect.
Right, we may very well have things flying in the sky, but that won't be the weirdest part of it. And exactly. We didn't. I like the way Eliezer put it in his speech. We did not conquer, flight because we could flap our arms. Okay, it was the human mind that allowed us to come up with airplanes, and you start messing with the base of the with the fountain that all these things come out of, our intelligence. And you invent something that's greater than that, as far as human intelligence, something greater than that, then you just can't predict what's going to happen, and that's cool there. But anyway, I agree with almost everything that Eliezer said, and which is wise of me. Eliezer is—he's a brilliant guy, and he's thought long and hard about these things, longer and harder than I have. I would just say that he emphasized the differences in these schools of thought. I would just emphasize that yes, they are different, and they are distinct, and you need to understand these distinct schools, but also that they work well together. Kurzweil and Benji are well aware of each other's ideas, and for the most part, I'm sure they agree with each other. They agree with what I.J. Good has said, and I checked, and I.J. Good is still alive, by the way. Yeah, he's 91 this year, and I imagine that to the extent he keeps up with it, he probably agrees with those two guys as well. So there's a lot more synthesis here than antithesis, and I just kind of wanted to point that out.
And I'm glad you brought that philosophical distinction in. These are not mutually exclusive. They are they tend to be more mutually reinforcing.
Right.
And also touching on your point that Mr. Good is still alive and kicking at 91. Another path that runs parallel to this is another favorite topic at the Speculist, and that's life extension and health extension into and beyond the first century.
Have you noticed some of these smart guys tend to live a lot longer than the average person?
I haven't noticed it, but now that you mention it, this sounds hopeful.
Yeah. Well, I guess it goes along with the adage, you know, keep your mind active and things, and that, you know, that tends to keep you healthy. These guys are super smart. I'm thinking Freeman Dyson's another good example. You know, these guys, they tend to live a long time, and maybe because they're keeping their minds active and thinking about things, maybe part of the reason. Anyway, there's one more point I wanted to make about Eliezer's speech, and then we'll go to the next topic. But he mentioned in his speech that there's room perhaps for a fourth school of thought about the singularity. He didn't know what that might be, but, you know, he was just throwing that out there. I'm not so sure that there is room for a fourth school. You know, accelerating change describes the most likely route to the singularity. The event horizon describes, you know, the singularity itself pretty well. And then I.J. Good's statement describes to the best we're able about the only thing we can say about what would follow the singularity. There's always more that you could say about the singularity, and we blog about it all the time. We talk about it all the time on this show and everything else. But I think that most of what can be added amounts to refinements on what has already been said and the three present schools.
Either refinements of the already presented, or a denial of the fundamental thesis that this is ever going to come about,
right?
And that we're going to move on around or along other developmental lines,
right? And I'd be interested in hearing those arguments as well. But anyway, in the last week's show, I stated basically that when a machine passes the Turing test, the singularity has begun. And I would say the reason that is because once you have human level AI, it takes human level AI to pass the Turing test, is what my point was. And once you have a human level AI, you know, how quick would it be to get slightly greater than human level AI? That's the singularity. And so that was my whole argument. But I don't think that's a forced school.
I don't really think so either. What I will add to that is, like any other kind of software, the first time it runs properly, it is, at that point, obsolete.
Yeah, that's right.
The answer to your question is, how long would it take to advance beyond human-level AI? About 10 cycles of whatever processor you're running it on.
Yeah, exactly, because it would shoot past human-level AI very, very quickly once it reaches human-level AI. But anyway, I don't think that's a forced school. I think that, you know, if to the extent that is an original thought, I would just say it's a gloss on what Kurzweil, Vinge, and Good have already laid out, and so that, you know, there's, like I say, there's always more to think about, more to say on the subject, but...
Well, and I would throw it open to our commenters, both on the phone lines and on the chat and in the comments on the Speculus weblog. If they've got ideas that might lead to a fourth school, by all means, throw them out there.
Share them with us, and we promise to be gentle in our critique. We always like to hear new ideas. But anyway, that's which brings me to a point I've been trying to work in here. Matt has started his own blog on future-related topics, and Matt has been such a good contributor to this show. I got to plug him. His new blog is Cognitive Kaleidoscope. I like that. That's a great name.
Sounds good. Hard to spell.
Yeah. Well, it's the URL for it. The address is www.cognitivekaleidoscope, all run together, .blogspot.com. And I'll have a link, Matt, for you. I'll link you from our show notes too. So that's
I'd be the first to thank you for that, Stephen. It would take me some heavy use of the spell checker to get to that one.
Yeah, well, it's kaleidoscope spell with a K, if that helps anybody that's listening. But yeah, you know, make it easy on yourself. Come to the show notes, and we'll give you a link straight to Matt. And look forward to reading your blog, Matt. Let's get to the next topic. Let's see what were we going to hit on? Oh, that's it. I wanted to play some of Phil's a montage of some of the interviews that Phil took at the Singularity Summit.
Oh, good. I've been looking forward to hearing some of these.
That's right, and he's been kind of I don't know. He's been working up the anticipation, I guess, on this.
Because
he'd drop a little hint every now and then that he's got he's got some of this stuff waiting in the cellar, but wouldn't bring it out until a special occasion. I guess this is special enough. So, anyway, the first montage is the hopes and fears of that the various participants of the Singularity at the Singularity Summit have concerning the Singularity. Let's listen.
I really hope it frees up more time for humanity to enjoy those things in life that would otherwise perhaps not, people wouldn't have as much time for. I'm really hoping it basically buys everybody a little more time for personal pursuits.
My greatest hope for the Singularity, I think, is that man as a whole becomes considered, more considerate, smarter in a good way. My wife, years ago, she wanted to invent a smart ray so that you could just, you know, as you're driving down the freeway and someone cuts you off, you could blast them with a smart ray, and they would get hit by it, and then they would think, oh gosh, that was rude, you know, why did I cut you off? But I think that at this point in sort of our society, our global society, and certainly in this country, we need more capable, more intelligent people actually making decisions that are good for the whole country, good for the whole world. And I'm not sure I see that. I see a lot of very narrow, short-term thinking going on, whether it's on Wall Street, whether it's in government, My hope is that we develop some sort of intelligence augmentation or capability augmentation that makes it possible for us to really run a world which has become more and more and more complex.
I guess my greatest hope for the Singularity, and by this I'm sort of meaning in my head, but I think that probably the next real thing that will profoundly affect us, that we might be talking around, and I don't know if this is what other people mean when they talk about the Singularity, but I think we'll probably keep increasing communication speed to the point where it's almost instantaneous, where we can all chatter with each other, and we'll become much more like some sort of macroorganism because of that. It'll become much more of a level where we're cells operating within a city, which is really functioning like a large organism. And that's what I see the singularity is, really. I think that's what we're really kind of dancing around. And that can go one of two ways. We can either lose our individuality through that by acquiescing to augmentation in ways that allow us to be subsumed by this sort of, I guess, super organism that we could become. Or if we're much more savvy about it, that might be a way to make us a much more accomplished and progressive sort of group as a whole class of humans, instead of, I guess, sort of getting lost in what we typically use technology for, which is just, you know, hitting each other in typical tribal warfare. If we could maybe move beyond that, I think we might have hope for the singularity yet. But as of now, I'm sort of distressed by the way that we seem to be allowing fear to rule everything that we do with technology, even when it seems to be in our best interest to allow it to grow large and sort of evolve on its own.
An increased emphasis on how we bring this together. So it's the educators, it's the social engineers, it's the entrepreneurs. I think we've got a great job of the an increased emphasis on how we bring this together. So it's the educators, it's the social engineers, it's the entrepreneurs. I think we've got a great job of the visionaries, and we've got a terrific job of having the academics, but we need those social, the social glue.
Greatest apprehension would be that mankind completely disappears, because I think mankind will disappear with the singularity, but not as a species, you might say. I think biologically we will ultimately disappear because of it, but my fear is that we will disappear in distinctiveness as well.
My fondest hope for the singularity is that we're going to create so much machine intelligence that people, the jobs left for humans, will be things that they absolutely love to do, things they're passionate about. I think that people thrive when they're using their talents. I think that we can achieve the best outcome of our future when we put each person to work on their talents, doing things that they love to do. And if we can eliminate some of the work that no one really likes to do, I think that we're going to have a much happier, engaged, and positive, and connected population.
All right. Michael, I don't know about you, but I was picking up a strong liberal vibe. I guess that's what you get. Yeah, well, and you would expect that, I suppose, in San Francisco at the Singularity Summit. But I, you know, kind of to go over it again, I mean, more time for personal pursuits was what the first person said. More intelligence for everybody to get society past narrow short-term thinking. That's what another person said. Instant communication, which could be a good or bad thing. We lose our individuality, or we use this to become a more golden rule-oriented social glue, is what another person said. The fear that mankind disappears, I guess that kind of goes back to losing our individuality. And the hope that people are more able to do the things that they are meant to do and want to do post-singularity. So, yeah. I thought that was some pretty good thoughts.
All good thoughts. I particularly like the concept of the smart ray.
At least
good humor there.
Yeah, exactly. Zap some of these drivers into understanding that. Well, that was rude. I shouldn't do that next time. So, yeah, that takes road rage kind of out of the equation, doesn't it?
Puts it in more positive light.
Yeah, that's right. If you're going to zap somebody on the road, that beats a 44 Magnum any day. So, yeah, I want to get into, Mike, a couple of other topics, but we don't have a whole lot of time left. And so we're kind of running out of time before we get through all of our topics. So I would just encourage... Yeah, well, we encourage everybody to tune in again next week. That means we'll just have more to talk about next week.
Always good to have more material.
Well, that's right. Did you catch the Fab Lab?
I saw a little bit about that. Can you give me some more details? I couldn't get the video to play here.
Okay, well, the Fab Lab, let me kind of just let everybody know. A Fab Lab is basically a printer that prints 3D objects, okay? They're also called rapid prototypers. And
sometimes called RepRaps, rapid replicators.
There you go. The whole point is you download a file into your machine that it would describe the product that you want to make, and then you hit print or whatever, and this machine goes to work, and it makes whatever you want to make, to the extent that it's able to. And so Fab Labs have been kind of primitive up till now, and they've been very, very expensive. Popular Mechanics has given a prize to these guys for releasing the plans for a Fab Lab that can be built with a small amount of money by somebody who's pretty smart. I mean, you have to kind of know what you're doing, and you have to be kind of a devoted hobbyist to do it. But you put this thing together and you download plans from the internet, or you come up with your own plans and then and make what you want. And the idea is that you can become an inventor. If you got some idea that you want to. That, you want to do something, and you want a prototype of whatever it is. Well, you just come up with it, you have this machine printed out.
So we're talking about the level of expertise that might be available to, say, someone who is confident working on their own car, or opening the hood on their computer and messing around with parts inside.
Yeah, and what I would compare it to is, you remember Mike, I don't know if you're old enough to remember. I'm just barely old enough myself to remember, but the Apple I and other kit computers back in those days, that was
something on the order of the Heathkit that we remember from Radio Shack.
That's right. You get all the parts together, you bring it home, you put it together, and that was a computer. And that of course, it wasn't long after that Apple decided to come out with Apple II, and that was all put together already and everything. But yeah, they said that this is basically the Apple I of Fab Labs or RepRaps or whatever you want to call it. This is the beginning of a revolution in manufacturing, and to me, I think that this is just a cool development, and you can imagine. Different and more expensive units being able to do more things, and they're talking about with this particular unit being able to actually put circuitry into things. And so not only are we printing out like the case for maybe a cell phone, but also the circuits for the cell phone, and everything else in it. So even the battery case. So that's cool.
Really cool.
Very cool.
I hear we also have another new take on creating new technological items.
How's that?
Apparently, scientists have... the title of the article is Let Nature Design Components.
Yeah, I saw that. Get us into that.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have the article here in front of me, but...
Let's see if I can pull it up real quick.
Okay.
Just remembering while I'm getting it pulled up, it's allowing nature to self-assemble things at the nano level, like a computer circuit board or something. And up till now we've known that things self-assemble in nature, but they do only a certain number of things. And we've seen it happen for years. We've known that these things happen at the nano level, but getting it to do what we want it to do, getting nature to do what we want it to do, has kind of eluded us. Well, here is one path to that, and basically what it amounts to is a template. If you pour a liquid on a tabletop, it just scatters in all directions. But if you have a template and you pour a liquid onto the tabletop, let's say it's hot wax you pour on the tabletop, and when it solidifies, then it would take on the shape of the template. Well, these are nanoscale level templates that might have like tracks for electrons to flow along to form a computer circuit, And these templates, according to the models that they're showing here, can be used thousands of times before you've worn out the template. And each time you're printing out at a very low cost computer circuits. And so it's something like
a rubber stamp for CPUs.
Exactly. And you just boom, stamp it out, and much cheaper than current technology for computers. And so. Again, this is just another route to keep Moore's Law in effect for even longer.
Outstanding. And to get more computers into more hands more cheaply seems to be another of those routes to the singularity that we were talking about earlier.
Right. Well, we are flat out of time, and we still had a couple of stories left to go. And so that, again, we want you all to join us again next Sunday night. Right here at Blog Talk Radio. It's 11 Eastern, 10 Central, 9 Mountain, 8 Pacific. As far as I know, that's where we're going to be every Sunday night. So join us for the live program. Michael, we've got some exit music this week from the band Bait. We've featured this band before in our October 14th show. The song this week, though, is Fill Me Up, and I found this band at magnitude.com. I think these guys are obviously talented. Give them a listen. Anything else you want to contribute before we wrap it up tonight, Michael?
None from here. Thanks for the good conversation this evening, Stephen, and I look forward to talking to you on next Sunday.
Okay, thanks. Good night.
Good night.
Oh, That was track number 3 from the album File and Rhythm by Bates from Magnatune.com.